Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Okay, we are in paper 92, section 5. We got into the section a little ways. We're on old single column, page 1009. And it's, if you have a book that's numbered paper section paragraph, it's the fifth paragraph, or if it's numbered paper section item, it's the eighth item. It's that paragraph that starts with, there have been hundreds upon hundreds. You know, right? So in other words, the preface paragraph to this next list that we want to go through. The point of this list, we last time in section 4, we went through that fivefold list of giving us a brief thumbnail sketch of each of the five epical revelations. And then we got into this section introducing the issue of the great religious leaders. And we were reminding ourselves of what they told us about how epical revelation, we're considering religion, you know, kind of specifically right now in this paper. But, you know, so how the religion that is being fostered in epical revelation gets to the evolutionary religion that it would ultimately like to influence, or maybe more precisely, say, eventually, right? Would like to influence, but there is no direct path for that. It has to get into the mores system. Yeah, the revelation has to get into the mores system, and then slowly, in the context of the mores system, evolutionary religion evolves some more to kind of refind its place as the kind of fundamentally vitalizing element in that culture. And that process of getting it into the mores system, remember how they pointed out in that little paragraph that we read at the end last time, and I'll reread it again here in a second, that that process of getting it into the mores system is very dependent upon leveraging off of a leader individual, that you need this very captivating, compelling, coercing individual to leverage off of and effectively get it into the bloodstream, as it were, of the evolutionary process. So let me just read that little paragraph again, and then we'll jump in where we left off as we get into the details of those leaders. Okay, so they were remember we were reading about how problematic, like all of these evolutionary necessities, you know, religious leaders are. They have all sorts of issues always, and they feed their biases into the system and whatnot. But they say, but regardless of the superstitious awe in which they were often held, it remains a fact that these teachers were the temporal personality fulcrums on which the levers of revealed truth depended for the advancement of the morality, philosophy, and religion of mankind. So the whole list of substantive elements, as it were, for civilization. It all depends upon these fulcrums of these great leaders. So they're going to give us a little review of how things have played out with Revelation feeding into the bloodstream of the evolutionary process since the days of Adam, and break it up into some blocks of time that we can consider had a certain flavor to them until something else changed the flavor, or the evolutionary process kind of changed the flavor. So let's see how they roll this out here.
There have been hundreds upon hundreds of religious leaders in the million-year human history of Urantia, from Anagar to Guru Nanak. During this time, there have been many ebbs and flows of the tide of religious truth and spiritual faith, and each renaissance of Urantian religion has, in the past, been identified with the life and teachings of some religious leader. In considering the teachers of recent times, it may prove helpful to group them into the seven major religious epochs of post-Saddamic Urantia.
Okay, so they're going to, up front, they're giving you that full context from the first great religious leader with those original, immediately post Andonanfanta Andonites, Anagar. Kind of got the whole significant evolutionary religious phenomenon going, all the way through to that very fertile time back a few centuries back, when you had both Martin Luther changing the way things were going with evolutionary religion and Guru Nanak. And if you're not familiar with Nanak, that's the individual that that basically launched Sikhism, out of that that Eastern religious context, in the Indian subcontinent area there. So we're just going to go up to there. We're not going to consider things that have happened in more recent times. For instance, one can can think about the things that happened in the process of getting this revelation into existence, and how there was a kind of a little priming of the spiritual system, a little bit of a mini spiritual quickening, sort of, to help the revelators flush out both a contact personality that they needed and a contact commission, and there's some corollary things that got spawned around the middle of the 19th century, as people got kind of a little more animated, a little bit more spiritually animated, and some gears turned a little bit. But we're not, we're not going to get into those very most recent things. They want to just basically span the space that produced very, very sweeping major religious reformations or spawnings, as opposed to the more, the lesser ones. Not that anyone's religious effort is to be deemed lesser, but just quantity wise, it didn't, encompass billions of people. Say, it's millions. Okay, so that's the scope. But they're not going to go all the way back to Anagar, as you see, in breaking it down like this. They're just going to consider the post-Adamic. And as you'll see as we read item number one there, they're not even really going to talk about the immediate post-Adamic, but down the road a little ways to something we've talked about way back. So let's read that item number one, and I'll tell you what I mean there.
Number one. The Sethite period. The Sethite priests as regenerated under the leadership of Amosad, became the great post-Adamic teachers. They functioned throughout the lands of the Andites, and their influence persisted longest among the Greeks, Sumerians, and Hindus. Among the latter, they have continued to the present time as the Brahmins of the Hindu faith. The Sethites and their followers never entirely lost the Trinity concept revealed by Adam.
Okay, before I get into the sort of the immediate relevant details, let's just consider that context there. Amosad, recall way back when we were reading about the Andites. Let's see, what paper is that? The Violet Race After Adam. That's paper 78. They mentioned him when they were talking about the Andite migrations. They were talking about how this period that you can see we're kind of skipping and just going to the Andites. So you had the preceding period. They say here for 20,000 years the culture of the second garden persisted, but it experienced a steady decline until about 15,000 BC. When the regeneration of the Sethite priesthood and the leadership of Amosad inaugurated a brilliant era. Okay? So they're reminding us of what they told us way back there. And as you saw what I just read, in other words, they're not starting say 35,000 BC, they're starting 15,000 BC. Okay. So, definitely not starting a million years ago. They're not even starting, in 35,000 BC. They're starting about 15,000 BC with the Andites, and how a lot of the cultural aggressiveness that we read about with the Andite migrations, that was produced by this very strong leader, and him recognizing that you needed a very vibrant, regenerated Sethite priesthood. It's called Sethite priesthood because it goes back to Seth, that son of Adam and Eve in the second garden, that was recognizing that the people needed some religious focus so that they didn't end up like his brother Abel. Right? You're not dealing with all of that kind of, especially at a time when things weren't migrating much and it was kind of just within the Adamites. They're starting when finally it sort of bursts free of sort of a preaching to the choir phenomenon and really goes out into the world. And produce the kind of influence that we're interested in, something that is sort of laid out over basically the whole planet, and in one way or another provides part of the substratum of religion on this planet. Okay, now the specifics, for instance, they point out some of those kind of oldest significant existing religions, they feed right into that with the Brahmins and Hinduism. And then they give you an interesting little tidbit that let's look at specifically what they say. That last sentence, the Sethites and their followers never entirely lost the Trinity concept revealed by Adam. Thinking about that sentence will help to focus us again on properly thinking about what's going on. Notice that they said revealed, because it's the second epical revelation, the Edenic teachings, revealed by Adam. Okay, so in other words, it's not like Adam told anyone about the Paradise Trinity in the way the Paradise Trinity can be talked about in the fifth epical revelation, with a full-on three infinite persons predicate, and then a super summative consequence, and then even beyond that to thinking about it genuinely top-down instead of bottom-up and all. Adam didn't talk to anyone in such incomprehensible, direct fashion about the Paradise Trinity. Okay? He didn't disclose the literal infinity of the Paradise Trinity. He revealed the Paradise Trinity. He revealed the truth of the Paradise Trinity. He didn't disclose the straight-on fact of the Paradise Trinity. Okay? So whatever he did was in truth awakening people to the fact of the Trinity. In the same way that we talked about those epical revelations, the planetary prince and his staff on any world, Adam and Eve on any world, they're revealing God the Father. They're not disclosing the literal infinite God. They're revealing God the Father. And so they'll reveal the truth of God the Father in a very, initially a very local context, literally a local system sort of context. See, and again, not talking about, we got this little local system in the midst of a grand, no, they're not doing it like that. They're not literally talking about local systems inside of constellations or anything like that. They're just, that's to give you an idea of kind of the scope of what they talked about, that in truth, it is a revelation of God the Father.
Eventually they get there though, right?
When you get to a bestowal son and that sort of stuff, right? I mean, you eventually are, at the same time that you're revealing truth as a revelator, you're disclosing ever more vast fact, right? Okay. But simple little minds, I mean, every Urantia book reader is still trying to wrap their minds around exactly what the Paradise Trinity is. Because in its fullness, it's very complicated and very abstract. When you let go of the kind of the crutch of looking at it bottom up as a supersummative consequence, which has got its issues, if you let go of that and really think of it in deity terms, okay, it becomes very difficult to wrap your minds around what exactly you're talking about. So I just wanted to belabor that a bit, to just use it again, because we're trying to get out of the old wineskins of thinking about what the word revelation means. We've been, it's been pounded into our heads from the moment we started listening to people talk. We have this bias in our minds about what a revelation is. And to get, you must let go of thinking about it factually first. You need to figure out what that truth notion is. And I'm saying notion because initially it's just this vague notion, okay, that you can't bring to a focus. You have to begin to challenge yourself to figure out that contrast of truth to fact in order to begin to appreciate what they were even referring to in that list of five epical revelations. Yeah. And it's not something that you've already been taught and you can just, I can remind you of it and you can just, pull that, index card out of your file, okay? It's not like that. It's a whole new way of thinking about what your mind can comprehend, what your mind can relate to in this very holistic, synthetic way where you let go of describing the details of parts for a moment. Okay, so anyway, this whole fact that feeds into the Sethite priesthood teachings, feed into the Brahmins, as they're pointing out, there's going to be sort of shadows of the Trinity concept here, there, and everywhere. Remember, we're about to get into detail on all these things when we get into the next block of papers, and we talk about Machiavelli, Melchizedek, and then all of the Melchizedek missionaries, and how they went here, there, and everywhere. They use that that context to talk in basic detail about all of these major religions. So, you know, we'll eventually get into, you know, where the shadows of the Trinity teaching from Adam, you know, are still in Hinduism, say. You know, that sort of stuff.
Back to your comment on Revelation. Mm-hmm. When I first got into your Angel Book, the only revelations I'd heard about were the Book of Revelations in the Bible.
Yeah.
Which, quite frankly, to me, I had a hard time making sense of it.
Right.
Because it was kind of mixed and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. I think that's where a lot of people start out who came out of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're immediately, you know, talk about this as a revelation. They, it's hard for them to correlate the new meaning of revelation to, in you know, contrast to the Book of Revelations in the Bible, I found. I mean, it's like, mm-hmm. it takes a while before,
yeah.
you know, they take it on in terms of a much greater meaning.
Yeah, and then even if you're not kind of immediately hung up on a particular you know, book of so-called revelation, like the Revelation of John, you know, just how people have talked about the a revelation for the last million years as being some sort of disclosure of details, especially you know details about the immediate material. Future and you know, am I going to find the love of my dreams? You know, okay, it was revealed to me in a dream. You know, we talk about it in these very silly materialist, you know, material oriented ways, and it's a long journey to try to get from such thoughts and such interests. I mean, why do I need to know about truth? What, you know, if I can't stub my toe on it, who cares? And you can't, right? So, you know, but this book is meant, you know, I mean, in Revelation in general on a planet, see, is always going to look for those people, even if it literally is a dispensational revelation, so it's going to go to everyone, but it's not going to go to everyone immediately. It's initially going to go to those people that have curiosity above the norm, right? And hence can have interest above the norm, right? They care about something besides the next hunt and the weather, okay? And in general, there aren't that many people that care about anything besides the next hunt and the weather. So, yeah, because it's unnatural to think about something else, right? And we all start out natural. Yeah, you have something?
Well, I just think you can't even hit somebody upside the head with the truth. It passes right on through.
Right. Right. You can't even pick it up. You can't even point to it. You know, you can't convey it in words. You know, I mean, you can't read it. You can't hear it. You can't. Right. I mean, it's very intangible. You know, and hence, because it's so intangible, that's why people that, you know, even people that are pretty certain there is such a thing, can't help but doubt, you know. And I was like, well, I don't know. Am I certain there really is such a thing, or am I just kidding myself? You know. And then almost everyone else is like, well, there obviously isn't such a thing. If you can't poke it, it doesn't exist. Okay. So that's how it starts out with the Andites going everywhere, going to the four corners of the earth. So they lay this foundation. It's not just that regional thing with the Adamites. Okay, the Andites, you know, lay a foundation over the whole globe eventually. And so that's where we start the story. Okay, then we go from the second epical revelation consequences to the third.
Number two, era of the Melchizedek missionaries. Urantia religion was in no small measure regenerated by the efforts of those teachers who were commissioned by Machaventa Melchizedek when he lived and taught at Salem almost 2,000 years before Christ. These missionaries proclaimed faith as the price of favor with God, and their teachings, though unproductive of any immediately appearing religions, nevertheless formed the foundations on which later teachers of truth were to build the religions of Urantia.
Okay, so you have the immediate wake of what Machaventa did. Remember, he, you know, we're just about to read about him in the next paper. He came in 1980 BC. or incarnated. He didn't come. He was already here. Remember, he incarnated and showed up for to human vision in 1980 BC. Okay, but there, like they've just pointed out, the immediate phenomenon is not long lasting. As they said there, though unproductive of any immediately appearing religions. So this is going to be just sort of a wave of revivification of a languishing Sethite foundation. And you're just going to kind of reanimate that Sethite foundation a bit with those Melchizedek missionaries going out. It's going to fade, we'll read about it, soon here, but we talk about it all the time. Remember that, for those of you who've read the book many times, the Melchizedek receivers were immediately very concerned that all their efforts were, doing this whole incarnation, were not going to get the job done. They were basically going to be to no avail, that it was still going to be nothing there by the time Jesus showed up, Michael showed up as Jesus. So you can see that right here. I mean, just, we've got just over a span of a few hundred years, they're already seeing a distinct tailing off and just filtering in and getting quite diluted. But it was enough, especially because, as we'll read here in the next block, in the next paragraph in a second, remember Melchizedek didn't just put that stuff out there that kind of went very overt and into the whole system and faded quickly like this. He also did some things behind the scenes, and those were more enduring, and were still in a solid state, if you will, after the very overt phenomenon had faded, and individuals could come out of that, and did, as we'll read about in a second. Okay, let's see what else we have there. Just again that. How we're not considering lots of minor great leaders and stuff. Remember what they said, there's been hundreds and upon hundreds of religious leaders. Okay, but we're just looking at these elements that are quite sweeping. As they said there at the beginning, your Urantia religion was in no small measure regenerated. Okay, so this was a very significant kind of cross-the-boards revivifying influence. Let's see. We said, these missionaries proclaimed faith as the price of favor with God. Remember, we read that when we did in the preceding section about the third epical revelation. Trust and faith, where faith is the second word. Faith is the foundational word. That's the immediate teachings. Getting some kind of a quasi-genuine faith foundation that some trust can be built upon. Trust in God can be built upon. Okay, so they're just reminding you of that basic element again. Okay, now what are they talking about when they say, nevertheless, you had a foundation that later teachers of truth built upon. What's that about? Let's read the next one.
Number 3, the post-Melchizedek era. Though Amenemope and Akhenaten both taught in this period, the outstanding religious genius of the post-Melchizedek era was the leader of a group of Levantine Bedouins and the founder of the Hebrew religion, Moses. Moses taught monotheism. Said he, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God. The Lord, he is God. There is none beside him." He persistently sought to uproot the remnants of the ghost cult among his people, even prescribing the death penalty for its practitioners. The monotheism of Moses was adulterated by his successors, but in later times they did return to many of his teachings. The greatness of Moses lies in his wisdom and sagacity. Other men have had greater concepts of God, but no one man was ever so successful in inducing large numbers of people to adopt such advanced beliefs.
Okay, notice we had a lot more said here in this little blurb, because we're getting something meaty here now, something really, you know, that's getting quite focused and significant. But we haven't gone very far forward. Right? You know, we're back, like they pointed out, in those, you know, ancient Egyptian times, for instance. We had some other leaders there too. But we're, you know, we're still back in the second millennium BC. You know, back before 1000 BC. It didn't take many centuries, in other words, for number two here to peter out, and this number three mode to start to be in play. And like I said, you know, the most significant individual, like they were just stressing, from that behind-the-scenes work that Machaventa did with the Kenites, out of that parallel stream steps forth into the main evolutionary context, this great leader Moses, matchless Moses, as they say. And notice what they stressed, just how significant he was relative to all the stuff we've been reading and all these preceding papers in this block on the evolution of religion, you know, which has been all about the ghost cult. Right, now we've got someone who is taking on the ghost cult very aggressively. A lot more aggressively than I take it on, and I take it on pretty harshly at times here as I'm talking. So I'm trying to, you know, give appropriate emphasis to what we're reading in the book here. But I'm pretty sure I haven't prescribed the death penalty yet.
Okay. I'll get that on the docket here.
Right, And here's where, you know, going back and considering Moses can be very helpful to the muddle that minds have gotten into in the present, you know, times here, where we're very confused about a leader. There is no such thing as a kindly mystic leader. You can't have some fuzzy, you know, smiley, you know, okay, no, you know, that's going to, you know, lead men to great ends. Yeah. They have to be definitive. Okay, they don't have to be, you know, ruthless or something, you know, and debased, okay, but they have to be definitive, very definitive, all right? There's a leader has to begin with stark attention steps, vivid. Right, the vividness thing, vivid attention steps, and Moses would do that. Killed several people, okay, and he's got everyone's attention. Okay, I'm serious about this, and they're going, "Yes, sir, yes, sir."
And he did it without any mass communication of any kind.
Yeah,
I mean, think about that.
Yeah,
they had Facebook, right?
Yeah, right. That certainly had Facebook, didn't they? How could you live without Facebook?
Yeah, Right.
Yeah, I mean,
all done word of mouth in personal.
Right. There wasn't a Hebrew language, okay, back then.
So it's interesting.
You know, written language. I mean, obviously they were talking. There was a language, but you know, you didn't have that written Hebrew language until, you know, much later on. He has to be very charismatic, right? Very definitive, and have a solid educational background that he's leaning on. Right? You know, he can't just be some, you know, unschooled individual. Like I was saying, I mean, he's in a tradition of schooling that's coming down from the teacher himself, Machaventa, right? A Melchizedek, the teacher's on high. Right? Teacher's teacher. You know, he's in a tradition of that kind of schooling. Okay, so he has some clarity that he's bringing forth. You know, but he, you know, we all know he's Yeah, he's like, me, Lord? I mean, he recognizes he's not the most brilliant person that's ever lived or something. So the greatness of Moses lies in his wisdom and sagacity. Right? Even though other men have had greater concepts of God, like they're saying there, think about that wisdom and sagacity line. What's the difference between the two? Remember back when we were talking about civilization and those leaders, genuine leaders of advancing civilization, we had three concepts that needed to be encompassed: wisdom, insight, and foresight. Okay, not just legacy, tradition, and convention. Okay, but dynamic living, wisdom, insight, and foresight. Here's wisdom. Insight and foresight are together in the word sagacity. All right, that's what they're referring to, is that wisdom, insight, foresight triplet. Okay, past, present, future. Encompassment. Okay, so see, he had that very definitive leader education and character that is indispensable. Okay, so but no man was ever so successful in inducing large numbers of people to adopt such advanced beliefs. And inducing, in very prickly fashion to begin with. But eventually, once you kind of get everyone's attention, you don't have to kill people every 5 minutes, then you just firmly lead them forward, and they willingly follow. Because remember what we were reminded of: we're programmed by the life carriers to follow a leader, right? To a fault. I mean, the content of the leader could be utter falsehood, but if they definitively manifest a leader nature, our programming kicks in and we'll follow them right over the cliff. We've got a difficult lemming thing to that programming from the life carriers that we need to keep our eye on. Many followed, inducing large numbers of people. And of course, it isn't just confined to the Jews. Right? You go to the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C., and who's carved on the building? Moses. Right? He became an extremely important foundation for there to even be a civilization going forward from ancient Andite times, right? That you can still have the, basically that Andite-esque spear point moving forward in time. And only now is it in jeopardy for the first time, right? And that's why the fifth epical revelation is here. Because, you've got the smartest people saying, you're not allowed to talk about Moses in the context of government. That's a violation of separation of church and state. Right? And you should scrape him off the Supreme Court building, et cetera. See, that's why there's an emergency. But here you see, they're reminding you of just how extremely important, not just religiously, as we're seeing, but because we know how he affected evolutionary religion, is he first influenced the mores system. And we're still living in a civilization that's predicated on that uplifted mores system. Right. What some people call a Judeo-Christian philosophy. Right. Moses is on the Supreme Court building not because of religion, because of Judeo-Christian philosophy. Anything else there? Let's see. Like I said, they mentioned Amenemope and Akhenaten. And then, of course, Moses, you know, we're going to read a whole bunch about them as we get into the next block of papers. Let's see. I guess we got everything there pretty much. Let's go into the next one here. So, just one little preface. Remember I was just saying, but you know, the reality is even with people like Moses and stuff, as you could see, they were pointing out, the monotheism of Moses was adulterated by his successors. Okay, so even that, in an immediate sense, they see this descending tale. Not a descending tale of potentiality, like they pointed out, because you know it was revivified, and there he is on the Supreme Court building, for instance. Okay, but it was tailing down in actuality. So the Melchizedek receivers are thinking, you know, this is just not going to work. I mean, we're probably going to have to do something really radical again to try to prop things up. And then suddenly, out of the blue, this distilling out of the hole, you know, not by the hands of any individuals micromanaging like Melchizedek receivers, you know, literally micromanaging like they were here with Machaventa, right? You have this spiritual quickening in the 6th century B.C. The mother stepped in, you know, where the downstepped hands of the father, you know, weren't having a lot of success. That which revelation was failing to accomplish, right, the God of evolution was about to achieve. Okay, and that's very important to remember that that's what happens with the 6th century B.C. It just comes out of nowhere, even for the celestials, like, whoa, we've been trying to get something in the water, you know, in the bloodstream, and haven't had any luck, but now, look at it, it's just boiling, you know, and great religious leaders are popping up everywhere.
Okay. It's strange to imagine that the Melchizedeks, with all of their orientation and however many scenarios they saw, that they would be, panicked, or this isn't working.
Yeah. Well, again, it's you know they're at a lot higher level than we are. They don't panic at the, you know, in a moment, you know, like we do every time something is slightly out of whack. You know, we're running around with our hair on fire. Okay, they're not like that.
Pretty logical.
But still,
Creator Son was coming here.
Yeah.
So I mean, logically, and they're in charge. I mean,
yeah.
Come on, guys.
Yeah, remember they, you know, they ask, it's like, well, you want to help us here? It's like, no, it's in your hands. Okay, so, you know, they're sobered by that, and it's like, okay, it's in our hands. And, you know, remember, they're not normally assigned to be leading worlds like this. Okay, that's not kind of what they're designed for, like a Lenanandek is. You know, it's... it's at a much higher, as I was about to say, you know, their concern is at a much higher level and a much less panicky, you know, level than ours. But still, they can see the writing on the wall. And it's like, well, I don't really know what else we can do. I mean, we have limits to how much we can play around and not be in rebellion ourselves. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, you know, they can't just do anything. Right, or they're going to be found in rebellion themselves. They just start really mucking around with things. So, you know, they're thinking, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if this is going to work. But, again, just a reminder that no one has to ever really panic, okay? Because every part is in the context of the whole, and the whole is unassailable. It is literally supreme. Okay?
Does it
and
matter to a true son of God, the whole
is right? You know, all earthly things can crash. All those parts can crash, but the whole that all those parts exist in does not crash. It cannot crash. Utterly unassailable. So you know, no one is surprised. Once they kind of get over the initial the initial startlement, you know, no one is really surprised when coincidentally, the whole sees to the integrity, you know, the real integrity of the parts. Right? You know that if there really is a problem with the parts, not just you think there is, but if there really is a problem with the parts, there's nothing to fear. There will be something that will coincidentally come into play, so that no real harm befalls the world. Okay, just the way it is. Okay, so that this wonderful event in the 6th century BC, that great spiritual quickening. Let's read about that.
Number 4, the 6th century before Christ, many men arose to proclaim truth in this one of the greatest centuries of religious awakening ever witnessed on Urantia. Among these should be recorded Gautama, Confucius, Lao Tzu, Zoroaster, and the Jainist teachers. The teachings of Gautama have become widespread in Asia, and he is revered as the Buddha by millions. Confucius was to Chinese morality what Plato was to Greek philosophy. And while there were religious repercussions to the teachings of both, strictly speaking, neither was a religious teacher. Lao Tzu envisioned more of God in Tao than did Confucius in humanity or Plato in idealism. Zoroaster, while much affected by the prevalent concept of dual spiritism, the good and the bad, at the same time definitely exalted the idea of one eternal deity and of the ultimate victory of light over darkness.
Okay, again, we're going to talk about all these individuals when we get into the Melchizedek Papers. Literally, like they're pointing out, 1 century, all of this happened. Not only what they're talking about directly, but kind of what they're reminding you of between the lines by mentioning the Greeks. 6th century BC is the awakening of philosophy, amongst the ancient Greeks. This is not just the spiritual quickening. This is Holy Spirit spiritual quickening, right? It's not just religious. But, you have the truths of government awakening in people's minds and, all kinds of just incredible dynamic, forward-looking insight, spawning energy is in the system here. And it's all just literally in the 6th century BC. And, if you consider like with Greek philosophy, you have a 3-century block. You have the 6th, the 5th, and the 4th centuries. The 5th and the 4th sort of fully flesh out everything that was awakened in the 6th. And obviously with the religions too, they aren't all fully formed, within 1 century. They, some of them continue to really kind of form, for many, 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 many centuries forward. But even though, this is far enough back that human scholars aren't certain about some of these individuals when they lived, or even if they lived, right? I mean, someone like Lao Tzu is fuzzy enough that, people even wonder if he was, a literal person. But they were all literal individuals, and they were all in that 1 century. It's Jainist. You had that, and they're the ones that are very concerned about all living things. Right. They definitely continue to foster a very, very universal sort of all life is sacred sort of mentality. Don't step on an insect, and once you invent the microscope, then it gets really complicated to not kill bacteria. but
let me show you my microscope.
But Yeah, but again, no matter how much you can take any of these and point out, well, that's kind of going to be an issue, or that's an issue. Right, they're all great religious leaders, spawning very significant, world-affecting reconceptualizations of the nature of God and humans' relationship to God and what have you. All right. Let's see, what else we have there? You know, of course, Gautama Siddhartha, you know, of course, becomes the enlightened one, becomes Buddha. And, and you know, them pointing out, you know, it comes to Confucianism and you know, ancient Greek, you know, that it's a little bit more in the philosophy mode than the religious mode directly. You know, I mean, think about the way the ancient Greeks and even to you know, all the way to until today, how we hold up Plato. I mean, how many times did Jesus use the fulcrum point of Plato, right, to leverage off of Plato's ideas to try to illuminate what, you know, and get people to recognize what he was saying? You know, he used the shadow analogy many times, right? I mean, because he knows all these people he's talking to know a lot about Plato's teachings and revere him as much as people revere the Buddha. Okay, and so you know he was leveraging off him just like we were talking about. You know, you can scan through the part four and see all the times that he did that. You know, not to mention how. You know, through Philo, as we'll see here in a second, Plato feeds into Christianity in terms of its that Judeo-Christian philosophy context that the Christian religion exists in. Let's see, what else do we have there? Okay, we you know remember we saw Moses going very directly at ghost cult notions. But some of those key elements are very difficult to lose and got revivified in the 6th century BC, like they make a point of extensively mentioning there was Zoroaster, dual spiritism. I mean, you know, I mean, the reason that any of you think in that dualistic fashion, you know, of God and the devil, you know, good and evil and all that, I mean, that's because of Zoroaster and how Zoroastrian thought was fed into Christianity. I mean, if you go back to ancient Hebrews, you know, you didn't have, you know, the white hat guy and the black hat guy, right? You just had God, you know, and both good luck and bad luck comes from one being, right? You didn't have the good luck being and the bad luck being. Yeah. So, I mean, it's only when you feed that dual spiritism from Zoroastrian that have revivified, further complexified and made acceptable dual spiritism from Zoroaster. You know, that's why you've got that in Christianity.
The devil.
What was that?
The devil.
Yeah, right. All the fixation on the devil. And, you know, why the revelation of John is written the way it is, right? The good guy against the bad guy, right? That's because of Zoroastrianism, right? You know, if it was a purely Hebrew, you know, ancient Hebrew-based thing, you wouldn't have a story like that. You know, not to mention, you know, not just the apocalypse or the revelation of John, but all the other near-biblical apocalyptic literature that was written, you know, back in those days, and you know, things like the Apocalypse of Peter that gave us a lot of the additional details of our whole notion of hell and demons and what have you. okay, so it wasn't all in vain what Melchizedek and crew did. You got the 6th century BC quickening. And sure enough, so there's something there for Jesus to uplift. Because no matter how clever an uplifter you are, you can't uplift nothing. You can only uplift a something. And that was the job of the Melchizedek to see to it that there was a something to uplift, no matter how slight. So now we come to the fourth epical revelation.
Number five, the first century after Christ. As a religious teacher, Jesus of Nazareth started out with the cult which had been established by John the Baptist and progressed as far as he could away from fasts and forms. Aside from Jesus, Paul of Tarsus and Philo of Alexandria were the greatest teachers of this era. Their concepts of religion have played a dominant part in the evolution of that faith which bears the name of Christ.
Okay, so, yeah, don't give you a lot, because of course you've got all of part four to expand on that item. But notice how it kind of is like what they were saying about Moses. That you have, Jesus of Nazareth is engaging the context that he finds, and that it was sort of, the pump was primed by John the Baptist, who in many ways was spinning up in very definitive fashion some of the ghost cult concepts, like fasting, say, or something. So, it's wonderful that he prepared the way, as it were, by kind of getting people interested, and so that they would listen to what Jesus had to say. But Jesus is immediately fighting against the ghost cult, just like Moses was, only it's not Jesus' place to start executing people to, get their attention and make a point about this. He's not there as a cultural reformer or whatnot. He's there as just merely a spiritual uplifter. Okay, so, he tried, and it, eventually he was almost completely thwarted by ghost cult fixation. But nonetheless, he, as they're pointing out, he made an impression at least upon a few individuals like Peter, Paul, and Philo, and they saw to it that a religion was spawned. With the whole ghost cult atonement doctrine, the idea of an anointed one as a redeemer and all those ghost cult concepts. But, Jesus decided, okay, I've just got to let it go into the ghost cult. There's nothing that I have the authority to, be dealing with there. And it's going to just be what it is. Yep, Gene?
I don't want to read too much into this, but it says progressed as far as he could away from fasts and forms. Just think about today, the emergency today.
Yeah.
This militancy against form. We must be talking about two different things.
Yeah, I mean, here it's just all those ritualistic forms of the ghost cult that everyone was ensconced in, like sacrifice and all that. That's what they mean by forms there. They use the word form there because they want you to think about the specifics of, say all of the Jewish ritual that Jesus was dealing with, not immediately precisely with the specifics of the rituals, but the fact that there is a ghost cult frame, there's a form that's superimposed upon the system, and everything conforms to that form. That's why they give you that specific thing like fast, okay? But in in general, that's just one element in kind of a whole context that is like I said, superimposed as a form effectively on the system. Now, this isn't, you know, don't interpret that word form there as directly and literally as you do when you start talking about, you know, the physics of the relationship of mind over matter, and you use that word form, and you use the word pattern, and okay, yeah, we're not being Aristotelian, you know, in our precision here. But nonetheless, it's, you know, the point is just to appreciate that you've got this whole context, and you know, every angle Jesus tried to take at it, you know, he would eventually butt up against it, because it's just, it's all encompassing. There's just this form that he's birthed into, and he doesn't have, you know, the authority to be reforming. So he just has to work into it, and more and more he had to go to plan B, plan C, plan D, you know, and try to find some way without rebelliously disrupting the form to nonetheless influence it in some hopefully lasting way.
Yeah, because if you think about it, he didn't really, well, he didn't provide the form for the new religion. That was done after he was gone.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, think about just what we were studying. I mean, the physics he's up against. He would love for his revelatory influence to modify evolutionary religion. But he knows he can't do that directly. He knows the only way to do that is through the Mori system. And he's just a spiritual uplifter. He's not supposed to be doing anything directly with the Mori system. Right? Economic, political, right? Sociologic, right? He's in a very difficult position of, you know, what exactly he can do. But he knows full well that he's not going to go directly from what he's saying into the religion. I mean, the religionists, you know, crucify him. Okay, I mean, nothing direct is going to happen there. His death is, you know, case in point. And he wasn't allowed to engage the Mori system. So, you see, the only reason that we even know of his existence historically is because of those who did engage the Mori system. Like they point out, to a fault, they wanted everyone to adopt the Jewish Mori system. You know, especially Peter. Paul was, willing to, it's like, no, let's not be so, they can kind of keep their basic Mori system, but I want to modify it. You know, they don't have to throw out their entire Mori system and adopt a Jewish one. Philo obviously helped with this too by helping to leverage off of some more 6th century BC stuff, like I was saying a minute ago, of the Greek philosophy, so that what was eventually constructed as a theology, a Christian theology, was even more widely palatable, thanks to people like Alexander the Great, right, spreading Greek thought, you know, far and wide. Okay, so, yeah, it's, again, I mean, if it was just Jesus, it wouldn't have gone anywhere. I mean, and he knew that. He knew that someone was going to need to be inspired by him and go directly at the Mori system so that it could get to evolutionary religion. Normally, right, a bestowal son has a prince's staff and an Adam and Eve regime, right, that I take what he's doing very precisely as a spiritual uplifter and relate it to the Mori system. But Jesus didn't have that. Okay, let's see, did we get everything else there? Just reminding you, you know, that the fourth epical revelation you know, and this kind of gets back to this, he's a spiritual uplifter, is not the teachings of Jesus, right? It is Jesus of Nazareth, like they said there, right? I mean, like, for instance, his faith, his spiritual faith, is the revelation. And, you know, faith is a pure inner life fact. It has no direct relationship to the external world and its mores system. Again, yeah, just to reemphasize what I was just saying. So, you know, when he's talking about seek first the kingdom of heaven, see, it's like, set your mores system aside, right, for the moment, and just, you know, go apart from it. It's just, so he knows what he's just potentializing, and nothing he's doing is going to immediately spawn a religion. All right, so now you've got the fourth epical revelation in the bloodstream, in a very evolutionary fashion. But the story isn't over. There are, you know, a couple more significant times since 2,000 years ago. And the first one here is in item number 6.
Number 6, the 6th century after Christ. Muhammad founded a religion which was superior to many of the creeds of his time. His was a protest against the social demands of the faiths of foreigners and against the incoherence of the religious life of his own people.
Okay, so this very specialized element, and again we'll talk about it a little bit more when we get into the Melchizedek papers, of the Arabs, you know, immediately it's the Arabs, always kind of being outside of a lot of the former influence. You know, like they were always, to a degree, apart from the immediacy of the influence of Mesopotamia or Samaria, etc. And even post Jesus, you still have these people that are in a very primitive mode. You know, every little clan of people has their own god. You know, and they're always getting trampled upon because of that. I mean, they're so divided. And along comes Muhammad, and again, taking a very, you know, Moses-like direct tactic. And before you spread the religion by the sword, you have to take the sword to the people that you're going to, you know, give this religion. So he aggressively lays into them and whips them into shape, gets them to get rid of all of their menagerie of gods, and gets them to adopt monotheism. And under that monotheistic umbrella, they can all come together as a major collective phenomenon for the first time. You know, and then off they go, you know, taking over vast tracts of the world because of that. Right? See, that's the power of a concept like monotheism. Next thing you know, there's Barbary pirates. Okay, so, but you know, he got them focused, and notice. You know, against the incoherence of the religious life of his own people. That's what I was just speaking to about all the menagerie of gods and stuff. But notice there's an interesting element to Islam, you know, or, you know, most immediately from Muhammad, Muhammadanism. His was a protest against the social demands of the faiths of foreigners. You know, remember, you've got people here that are not only, you know, being engaged by Jews, you know, with the Jewish ideas of God, but you've got all the Christians, you know, at them too, and they're not liking what either are selling. Okay, so. Muhammadanism has spawned, you know, to a high degree in reactionary fashion to them. You know, it's as much not them as it's something in and of itself. So not surprising that still to this day, you know, Muslims have a lot of issues with, I'm not them. I'm not those Jews. I'm not those Christians. See, the religion was spawned in reactionary contrast to them. You know, so no wonder they're infidels. You know, it's just kind of codified in the founding of the religion. So, I mean, everyone has to keep that in mind. This isn't some thing that developed, you know, down the road. It's what launched the religion. It was being against them. So you can't just, you know, have them, you know, they're not going to easily throw that out. It's a founding principle, you know, that I'm an infidel. You're an infidel. So that's why we have a lot of problems with that religion, the way it was spawned. You know, and remember how they help illuminate that some. It's like we, you know, we already mentioned about how Peter was wanting everyone to adopt the Jewish mores system, you know, in a very, you know, heavy-handed way. You know, and what were those early Christian missionaries doing? You know, they blew up the whole, you know, school of religions trying to get together, you know, and talk to one another. I mean, you know, because they were so heavy-handed, you know, my way or the highway. So all of that my way or the highway sort of, you know, mentality, those Arabs, you know, were very fed up with that. Okay, so now the interesting thing is the symmetry here. I mean, you've got, you know, Jesus in the middle, and you go on the one side, you've got the 6th century BC, and then on the other side, you've got the 6th century AD. That's kind of an interesting little symmetry, and it kind of extends to, you know, having something, you know. You know, here at the 15th century, they're going to read about next AD, you know, and back, you know, roughly in that ballpark was what we were reading, you know, before the 6th century there. So I don't know what to make of that, but it's kind of an interesting, you know, symmetry about the Jesus center point there. And before... before we read this next one, okay, just like with the them saying it's 6th century, okay, Muhammad is born in the 6th century AD. Things obviously don't get going instantly, right? I mean, it immediately is carrying over into the 7th century and et cetera. The same thing when they talk about the 15th century here. I mean, the individuals are born in the 15th century, but, you know, the movements aren't necessarily fully spawned in the, you know, or maybe even hardly spawned in, you know, literally in the 15th century. That's just when, you know, remember, we're reading about the leaders, and they're reminding you that just the way they're talking about it as being, say, a 15th century thing instead of a 16th century thing. Right? It's not when the full-blown phenomenon was institutionalized. It's when a person was born. Right? That individual spawns an age. His birth spawns an age. That's if you're familiar at all, you know, with these things, it's like, well, I don't know. If you really think of Martin Luther... you know, Lutheranism is being a 15th century thing. Don't think about it like that. Right? It's Martin Luther was born in the 15th century. You know, and even if he's kind of towards the end of the 15th century, still he's born in the 15th century. Okay. Let's see. Anything? Oh, and then let me wait until afterwards. Let's read this one first, and I'll say one more thing here.
Number 7, the 15th century after Christ. This period witnessed two religious movements, the disruption of the unity of Christianity in the Occident, and the synthesis of a new religion in the Orient. In Europe, institutionalized Christianity had attained that degree of inelasticity which rendered further growth incompatible with unity. In the Orient, the combined teachings of Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism were synthesized by Nanak and his followers into Sikhism, one of the most advanced religions of Asia.
Okay, so I already kind of, talked about Nanak and Sikhism, that they're giving us those details. He's a synthesizing individual. He's taking, an essence, as it were, from Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism, and synthesizing that into a new, more definitively monotheistic, approach to religion. And of course, you've got the Reformation, right? It started with Martin Luther and all of his immediate compatriots in that process. It's obviously the other thing we're talking about there, being launched by the inelasticity phenomenon, where Luther was feeling ever more shackled, right? By this ever more fossilized institution he found himself born into. The interesting thing to think about with the 15th century is, okay, so when is that kind of in the bigger scheme of things? So you have the Middle Ages from the 5th century through the 9th century, is from the 5th century through the 13th century. Okay, then you have a 3-century block of 14th, 15th, 16th. Oh, 15th, so it's right in the middle of that next block of 3 centuries, which is called the Renaissance. Right? That mode of being born again. You go, oh, wait, Renaissance? Look back at the first paragraph we read tonight, right? Look at how they literally told you that. During this time, there have been many ebbs and flows of the tide of religious truth and spiritual faith, and each renaissance of Eurasian religion has, et cetera. Okay, here's literally, the block of 3 centuries we call the Renaissance. Right? And these people, these two individuals, Martin Luther and Nanak, are being born right in the middle of the Renaissance. I'm giving you that bigger context to remind you that it's not just religious leaders that are defining ages here in our recent history. There's a bigger sort of age-defining influence that's going on. You have a long time of darkness with the Middle Ages, and then there's a born-again phenomenon. There's a Renaissance, and then there's 3 centuries of the Enlightenment. 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. So all of this is happening in a general civilizational or cultural sequence as well. Kind of keep that in mind, how this sort of sinks in. That's why I'm pointing out how this is right in the middle. It's sinking into that which you might say is kind of a more of a philosophic patterning of the ages.
So things were too inelastic for growth. Kind of implying, though, that the loss of unity is a real loss. It's a heavy price to have to pay.
Yeah, it is. Especially when you're talking about religion, which is us individuals attempting to relate to unity, right? I mean, remember, think about this in a more direct sense of unity, and you know, not uniformity of individual behaviors. You know, not poor man's unity, but genuine unity. If religion is really about a direct relationship with unity in contrast to individuality, you know, they're pointing out you're losing some of that basic sense. Say Lutheranism might have brought some cultural improvements and things, but it's at an expense where, at least initially, the phenomenon is less genuinely religious. It's less related to unity. And this kind of gets back to us thinking about, you know, the evolutionary religion is really just all of the details of the ghost cult. You know, and we can, our tendency, like with the Reformation, we reformed and got back to a better ghost cult. But it was at the expense of, you know, in some ways of losing a subtle unconscious relationship to unity, because you're thinking more them and us. See, and even though, you know, everyone being in one group isn't literally unity, the more you focus on individuality, the less your mind is relating to unity. See, so it's indirectly influencing relationship to unity by, you know, that's why multiculturalism is so corrosive, right? It's turning our minds unconsciously away from unity and fixating on individuality. Identity politics is so horrendously corrosive because it's turning minds away from unity. And often in the name of unity, right, turning minds away from unity and fixating on individuality. You're black, you're white, you're male, you're female. It's very, very corrosive, these thoughts, because, like I said, mostly unwittingly, it's actually, doing the opposite of what they're consciously thinking they're doing. I'm all about unity. No, you're not. You're an abomination to relationship to unity. You're why there's an emergency on this planet. This corrosive turning away from unity that is happening. And if mankind's minds have no identification with unity and only individuality, what happens to associativity? It disappears. So is civilization, which is an association, going to hold together? No, civilization will collapse. We'll just be a bunch of island universe individuals with no associativity. All right, so it's very problematic to lose that, you know, what for all of human history has been mostly kind of an unconscious relationship to unity, but a relationship to unity that revelators, leaders have wittingly or unwittingly primed an identification in that way. Seek first the kingdom of heaven. All right, seek first identifying your mind to unity, then deal with the individuality issues.
All right. From some other place, they talk about this being one of the mother or father of the secularism in terms of the strictness of the church and so on and so forth, and,
mm-hmm.
Which is another, as you can see, and you mentioned it a minute ago when we were talking about even the strictness of Abner's teachers who went to Urmia, mm-hmm. split up pretty quickly because they were non-compromising,
yeah.
so to speak. But the same thing here, it seems that the secularism thing that began then and now is getting to the point where they're throwing out the baby with the bathwater, or God with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just as much dangerous. Not dangerous is a wrong word, but just it is the right word.
No, it is. I mean, there's the section in part four is about secular totalitarianism, right? Not ecclesiastical totalitarianism. Yeah, right. Right, that's the big problem, and we won't get to it tonight. But that's how the next section ends up, is getting into those issues of humanism and secularism. All right, but anyway, so in seven, ages here, basically, they've gotten you to consider the relationship between revelation, epical revelation, and religious leaders, with a little bit of help from the mother thrown in, like with the 6th century BC and what have you, a little bit of contextualizing assistance. But you play out over that whole span, and as we get into the next section, they're going to talk about when all is said and done, what does all of that fall to all produce? What do we have today? Okay, but before we get to that, we've got one other little thing they're going to throw in here at the end.
The future of Urantia will doubtless be characterized by the appearance of teachers of religious truth, the fatherhood of God, and the fraternity of all creatures. But it is to be hoped that the ardent and sincere efforts of these future prophets will be directed less toward the strengthening of interreligious barriers and more toward the augmentation of the religious brotherhood of spiritual worship among the many followers of the differing intellectual theologies which so characterize Urantia of Satania.
See, I was just talking about that. All right? They're hoping that we can get back to those who, in one way or another, foster, catalyze a re-identifying or a strengthening of identification of our minds with the unity side, and not just ever more fixation on individuality. I'm a Lutheran, you're a Catholic. Okay? And that is, none of those things, those are tribal cultural differentials. That has nothing to do really with religion. They're isms after all, right? Catholicism, Lutheranism. They're taking some part, and falsely exalting it into the whole as an ism. It's not totally fixated on an individual like Buddhism, this is just fixated on the Buddha, or Mohammedanism. Okay, it has that at least. At least it's, if it's, say, Catholicism, right, it's a little bit more spread out. Lutheranism does have that Luther guy's name right in it, though. That's one of the downsides. Even though these religious leaders are very necessary, like they were stressing, they're an individual, and that could get your mind a lot more biased to individuality, to the neglect of unity, and hence de-religiousizing your mind. See, it's pretty ironic that the religious leader ends up having a de-religiousizing influence, a de-unity relating influence on your mind. Gets you all fixated about the external world, the outer life, and individuals, and are you a Catholic? Are you a Catholic, etc. And just all of those outer life issues. Why did Henry VIII, break off? Right? It certainly wasn't issues of the inner life. Kind of outer life issues, right? But nonetheless, you spawn a new religious sect, and the evolutionary process can do some, attempt to do something anyway positive with it. An Episcopalian isn't defined by Henry VIII. So, you know, the evolutionary process will always do something positive, but notice how there's the bottom line is just what I was saying about with item number 7, wanting us to remember that the whole point of religion is that inner life related to unity that has nothing to do with rituals or, you know, any of that stuff. Doctrines, theses nailed to doors. It does have some relationship to some basic ideas like by grace alone. After all, we've been, you know, all these papers on the evolution of religion. Remember, the only reason it's valid to call any of this stuff we've been reading about religion is because of grace. By grace alone, you have a superconsciously, you have a reality that casts the shadow that we've been reading about. Right, but the shadow is not the substance. Shadow is a bunch of material falderall. You know, believing that prayer is a material technique and all that sort of stuff. Right? Yeah, to really redouble our efforts, if you want to try to be a great religious leader, a lesser religious leader, or someone that's kind of influencing in that mode, remember that the whole point, you're trying to get the mind to seek first the kingdom of heaven, to first identify with unity and eternity, and then address the issues of individuality and time. Okay, so now let's just throw it in a blender and see what we get here when all is said and done.
Section 6, the composite religions. 20th century Urantia religions present an interesting study of the social evolution of man's worship impulse. Many faiths have progressed very little since the days of the ghost cult. The Pygmies of Africa have no religious reactions as a class, although some of them believe slightly in a spirit environment. They are today just where primitive man was when the evolution of religion began. The basic belief of primitive religion was survival after death. The idea of worshiping a personal god indicates advanced evolutionary development, even the first stage of revelation. The Dyaks have evolved only the most primitive religious practices. The comparatively recent Eskimos and Amerinds had very meager concepts of God. They believed in ghosts and had an indefinite idea of survival of some sort after death. Present-day Native Australians have only a ghost fear, dread of the dark, and a crude ancestor veneration. The Zulus are just evolving a religion of ghost fear and sacrifice. Many African tribes, except through missionary work of Christians and Mohammedans, are not yet beyond the fetish stage of religious evolution. But some groups have long held to the idea of monotheism, like the one-time Thracians, who also believed in immortality.
So, it's like, whoa, we're back to anthropology, aren't we? like I said, you know, you've got the entire history of everything we've read in this whole evolution of religion, and it's put in a blender, but it's not on liquefy. Okay, it's a very coarse chop, and you end up with all these composite religions, and you literally, like they're pointing out, have ongoing embodiments alive on the planet today of every stage from the most very beginning primitive stage, pre-Onagar, you know, up to someone that's trying to take what Jesus said out of the ghost cult and everything in between. Since it's very if you aren't well educated in anthropology, I mean, talking about like Dyaks, okay, in other words, Borneo, you know, so down in Southeast Asia, You're going to be an island of Borneo. You've got all those peoples. You know, one of the big things there that's been difficult to get them off of is headhunting. Okay. They've always loved their headhunting. You know, remember we read about all of the human sacrifice and cannibalism and all kinds of stuff. Right. So you've got all peoples in all these different stages of everything we've read about, no matter how grotesque or primitive it might be to us. You know, it's the most sacred, solemn thing to them. Okay? It's the fanciest thing they can think of. They're the heights of their reverence are in play. Okay? It's their religious consciousness. And the Zulus, great embodiments of that zeal of the sixth adjutant, you know, and they're talking, how did they word that? A man's worship impulse up there in the first sentence of this paragraph. Right, the sixth adjutant of zeal. Why did they invent the Colt 45? A bigger slug. Right, because even when you shot a Zulu, they still killed you because they had so much momentum in their zeal. Right, you kill them and they're dead and they're flying through the air with their spear and they still kill you. Right, so you needed a slug that was big enough to literally shove them backwards. Okay, it takes a 45 slug to counter the sixth adjutant. Okay, that's what we're that's the kind of stuff we're talking about here. The Thracians, those are those. Those peoples, basically to the north of Greece and the west of the Black Sea, back in ancient times, like they're talking about there.
Now, four or five different countries.
And all of the hodgepodge stuff that we we know is that goes on in all that area, right? It's all very common. And so they're just reminding you of it's. We have this incredible, complicated patchwork, hodgepodge of things. And a lot of that, a lot of the basic differentials you can begin to understand them by going to that religious nucleus and considering that contrast, before you go into full anthropologist mode and consider all of the greater more construct about that religious nucleus. A lot of these differentials have a very immutable religious core, so you can't just play around with, the filigree, like, trying to get the dyaks, not being headhunters. Okay, you can pass all kinds of laws and stuff. In other words, stuff that's even transcendent of, their greater moray frame and stuff. Okay, you're not penetrating to their core religious concepts, right? And so you're going to find that they might have a tendency to, revert to the old modes, no matter how much you try. And all of, like they're pointing out, Africa is just, of course, the test bed for this. You've got insanely primitive stuff and insanely immovable stuff. You can send Christian missionaries there until you're blue in the face, okay? And there's a strong tendency that the moment that Christian missionary, blinks, or leaves, it has a tendency of material gravity will just kind of take it all back to where it was. But what material gravity is condensing it around is a religious nucleus. And like I said, it doesn't matter how much it appears to be primitive and easily dismissible to you, it is their most reverent, sacred thoughts. Okay? We need to reappreciate that. In the Western world, it is ever more secular, like you're saying, is ever less likely to appreciate, give that even any consideration. Right? The so-called, progressive individual in the United States thinks that any religionist is an idiot. No, I mean, this is not going to lead us anywhere we want to go.
So these guys are either going to perish or they're going to have a slow process that actually meets them where they are.
Then we can kind of step aside from this. It's like, okay, let's assume Machiavelli and Melchizedek assumes planetary prince in the not-too-distant future. This is what he's dealing with, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, 500,000 years ago and for 300,000 years after that, the prince and his staff had everyone all on the same page and were slowly moving forward. Yeah. I mean, how do you set up a planetary regime that deals with those of us who are reading the book in this room right now and pygmies at the same time? Whoa, complicated. Right, I mean, if you haven't even really gotten even the most rudimentary stuff going yet. So at the same time that we're contemplating the reality of the Paradise Trinity, you know, as a facet of deity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, you've got pygmies. Right? So that whole bit they're telling about at the end of the preceding section about these religious teachers, you know, teachers of religious truth, the Father of God and the fraternity of all creatures. Oh, man, how do you set up a fraternity with creatures that are this diverse? I mean, you can't get people on the same page when some of those people don't even know what pages are. Right. Wow. This is, you know. So, yeah, how delusional is it that, you know, you've got people that are thinking, I'm pretty sure light and life is just a couple. I mean, it's going to happen in my lifetime even. You know, it's like ridiculous. This is so ridiculous.
Personal handbook for fusion.
What kind of a non-rebellion influence is going to bring this menagerie together? And how long would that non-rebellious evolutionary influence take? I mean, a million years hasn't moved the pygmies one iota.
Yeah.
See, as a matter of fact, it's like, well, they've only been around, you know, basically for 500,000 years. Yeah, but they dropped back to a million years ago, right? And it's as if, you know, they've been here unchanged for a million years. Yeah, at least, you know, the degree to which, you know, quote-unquote well-minded people, you know, don't muck with them, right? They have a stable culture, you know, it's ongoing. Yeah, but, you know, there's always someone that wants to, an idealistic person that wants to go in and help them and improve their situation, teach them about women's rights or something. It's like, oh, my Lord. Okay. That is like so down the road from where they are.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And we're giving them laptops. Good. And of course, the only thing they use them for is porn. You know, and this is the way it is. I mean, it's just, you know, you have to face facts. You can't be idealistic, ridiculously idealistic about this stuff. You know, so. Anyway, back to the composite religions here. Let's see, was there anything else we needed to point out there? Oh, I just you know, notice why they threw in the comment at the end about the Thracians. Long held the idea of monotheism. Also believed in immortality. You know, they're reminding you that you can have some of these groups that on the one hand might have sort of primitive religious primitive religious system, but they'll embody little nuggets, you know, especially if they're kind of in that near region to the Fertile Crescent, and hence, you know, Adamites and Nodites and stuff. I mean, they might embody some kind of non sequitur advanced thoughts in the midst of other stuff that's kind of clueless. And so, you know, that's what they're doing between the lines there, is just reminding you again of this, how we've thrown all this in this coarse chop blender, and have all sorts of curious little nuggets from the, the Noddites, influenced them, way back when, and they're still holding on to that or whatever. It's a very curious hodgepodge that we have. All right, let's get some more here.
On Urantia, evolutionary and revelatory religion are progressing side by side while they blend and coalesce into the diversified theologic systems found in the world in the times of the indictment of these papers. These religions, the religions of 20th century Urantia, may be enumerated as follows.
Good read the list.
1. Hinduism, the most ancient. 2. The Hebrew religion. 3. Buddhism. 4. The Confucian teachings. 5. The Taoist beliefs. 6. Zoroastrianism. 7. Shinto. 8. Jainism. 9. Christianity. 10. Islam. 11. Sikhism, the most recent.
Okay, so, and, you can think back, Hinduism, the most ancient, they mentioned how you had those Sethite teachings feeding into the Brahmins and stuff, so you've got some very ancient roots to Hinduism, and religious scholars recognize how incredibly ancient some of those Hindu roots are. And then, Hebrew, goes back almost as far in many ways. It certainly has stories in Genesis, that harken way back to Adam and Eve and whatnot, and et cetera, building forward. So, you have these main elements, in a lot of ways, it's like the elephant story, one is a trunk, one is a tail, one is a leg, et cetera. We have all these kind of parts of the picture that people have, over centuries, have codified and elaborated and ismized. Now, the other stuff they say there, in a little preface, notice how they start out on Urantia, evolutionary and revelatory religion are progressing side by side while they blend. I told you the blender analogy wasn't totally out of the blue. while they blend and coalesce. And, just them also, evolutionary and revelatory religion. Like I said, a coarse chop on this so that, it's not like you liquefy the two together and it's all one evolutionary stream. You've got, in some ways, revelatory concepts that are evolving relatively independently of the basic ghost cult evolutionary thing that continues to evolve. And, they come at loggerheads and there's cross currents and whatnot. It's a very complicated system. The very fact that someone like Martin Luther could look anew at the New Testament and kind of re-highlight, the parts that feel a little bit more revelatory, and he's kind of sort of unconsciously recognizing that, it feels like there's aspects to this that are lesser, right? In other words, this is the old wineskins, but this, I get a sharper reality response with this element, and I want to really hold that up and kind of.
Calvin in on this too?
Yeah, and then of course, immediately, subsequent to Martin Luther, you had all of the other Protestant reformers, stepping in as well, yeah. It immediately became quite complicated, the whole Protestant Reformation, but. Anyway, for someone who's interested in engaging the religions of the world, the revelators are trying. It seems like, couldn't I just kind of get most of this in some encyclopedia or something? It's like, not in this very well coordinated, summarized fashion, and in the context of the revelation. So that you can step back or step above and try to reflect on this and think about this more objectively, If you're an interfaith, quote unquote, interested person, you can't be ignorant about the actual facts of the composite religions of this world. If you're going to have any possibility of being effective in engaging them, right, you need to really understand, how a Jew came to be a Jew, how a Buddhist came to be a Buddhist. You can't just go in, well, all men are born equal, and it's all just irrelevant different names. And it's like, no, these are very solidly nucleated and rigidly held structures that have a vast evolutionary predicate to them, and so there's all kinds of inertia to them, and you need to engage the facts of people and not your wishful thinking about people. You're not going to be effective in approaching them as figments of your imagination. But the facts of it is very difficult. Right? And this list, is totally ignoring all of the people on the planet, like they're mentioning in the first paragraph, that really aren't, in this whole, they're still in just some very basic ghost cult thing with almost no revelatory influence, right, that would make it Hinduism, say, or something. How often are you, thinking of the pygmies in your interfaith contemplation? They're just as much humans as you are. They have thought adjusters just like you do post-Pentecost and whatnot. I mean, they all do. They're just as loved by the Universal Father as some fancy Hindu, some fancy Buddhist.
So do you imagine on normal planets where there's, central planetary government and, Adam and Eve and gardens all over the place, that they have these many different religions?
No.
That doesn't sound like
to me. No.
So this is unique.
I was going to mention that. You just reminded me. Go back to the very first sentence in this section. 20th century Urantia religions present an interesting, let's put quotes around the word interesting, interesting study of the social evolution of man's worship impulse. Right, people come from all over. It's like, you're not going to believe what it's like on 606 of Satania. I'm sure the primary midwayers hand out a scarf so that to hold your mouth closed, you're just, your mouth is hanging wide open as they're just walking around agog, trying to wrap their minds around what they're seeing on this world. It's like, oh my goodness, what a menagerie. I mean, where do you even begin?
What's this for? Well, you'll see really quick.
Remember that story about Christmas time and this guy that had the
let's say this is where they begin. You're saying gosh, how am I going to deal with this problem? No wonder I haven't taken over yet. It's like, so maybe this this book in our lap, so to speak, is where they begin. And by giving us this information, which we know is a lot of it is way beyond what a lot of people get on a lot of worlds, so to speak. And as you've mentioned many times, there's only a few people that are ready for it at this particular time. But some of it's real. I mean, some of it can be more generalized. So if this is where they begin, so to speak, okay, we're going to give them a revelation of truth. And that is going to somehow ingrain itself one way or another in cultures, which will allow us then to be able to come in with a little bit more, kind of like Melchizedek did for Jesus in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Same pattern, so to speak. My biggest thing is that, you know, wondering is that as we sit here and we get really enthusiastic and we've been doing reading the book our whole lives, you know, it comes to a point, like anything else, where you want to do, you know, you've got a calling in what you're doing, but
yeah.
people want to do something,
right.
you know, whatever we can do to try and help them,
yeah.
or help,
yeah.
you know, help do something. And the wisdom behind that is the trick,
right.
to me.
Yeah.
Is, you know, is it a, is the wisdom, you know, as you say, to try, you know, the parable of the sower cast seeds, some will land here, some will land there, some will land mm-hmm. there, whatever. Or is it to, you know, be very central? You know, and they have different examples of different things that work both ways.
Yeah.
It's not an easy,
no.
didn't come with a handbook of.
No, and in many ways, you know, the answer might be, it's like, well, I can't wrap my mind around all the details, so maybe I should simplify first, try that. How about if I try to help someone? Not someone, okay, but someone. Let me try to get one-on-one with an individual in a personal enough way that there could be a genuine influence, and because of that, a mutual influence. I mean, I won't just be helping them, they'll be helping me if I actually draw close enough to them personally. Because they're a child of God that could offer you something too, no matter how much you're not initially looking at them that way. The whole pre-public ministry of Jesus is definitely trying to foster that example. Right? He's approaching... you know, this one person, and then this one person, and then this one person.
Seldom do you meet with more than one.
Right, right.
Sometimes two.
Right, right. Because it's just, especially, I mean, when none of us are fancy third circlers like Jesus going around the Mediterranean, okay? Maybe you can handle one. You know, let's start with one before you try two or three. So, yeah, I mean, and again, because there are those who are in charge of the external world, the Most Highs and whatnot, and, you know, Machiavelli and Melchizedek is working on how he's going to engage this menagerie when he assumes planetary prince. I mean, all the revelators just developing this revelation is probably part of a bigger process of them working on this, sorting through this, you know, in the Melchizedek universities and stuff. I mean, you know, it's like, okay, you know, because eventually that one Melchizedek, Machaventa, has to have kind of worked through, at least theoretically, how to approach all this. You got to lay out all the facts, get them all in their proper historical context. And, you know, so this is probably part of that process of prepping. You know, the wisdom, insight, and foresight to take on the task. And like you said, I mean, I'll bet you there's not a lot of other people that are going, well, why should Machaventa get that job? I think I could do that job. It's like, no, I think I'll let him have it. It looks like a good... I'm sure not many people are volunteering.
Well, this has given us a good view of this, the width, the mm-hmm. scope of issues. So in the way that your answer book gives us a corresponding high,
mm-hmm.
high enough
a high
perspective
vantage.
Yep. to encompass. It has to all be encompassed.
Yeah.
You can't come down and leave off the edges.
Yeah, yeah, because you can't, your arms aren't that, you know, that long. Yeah.
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So you've got the point. See, and that's exactly how Machaventa is going to deal with it. You know, I mean, it's not by getting a bigger being that has bigger arms to wrap around that more, you know, diversity in the plane. You just go up higher and higher and higher until just automatically the cone of projection from that high vantage point spans the whole horizontal space. You know, that's the way, you know, in truth, see, it will be accomplished. And then you just have to have the technical skill bring that the scope of truth down, you know, in relationship to the details. But yeah, obviously, Yeah, you have to have a very high vantage point to span such a broad space, horizontal space. Yeah. And so, you know, it kind of reminds you again why this book span, you know, starts at such a high point. Yeah. All right, let's just read a little bit more of the details about these, and then we'll wrap it up for the night here. Three more paragraphs here.
The most advanced religions of ancient times were Judaism and Hinduism, and each respectively has greatly influenced the course of religious development in Orient and Occident. Both Hindus and Hebrews believe that their religions were inspired and revealed, and they believed all others to be decadent forms of the one true faith.
Okay, so positive things first.
Ready, set, go.
Yeah, not only are they the oldest, but as they're pointing out, they embody sort of the bottom substrate of all this, kind of spans underneath everything. But the very fact that they have some definitive influence, you know, conscious recognition of a revelatory influence is a double-edged sword. Right? It has a strong tendency to be problematic and go to people's heads. You know, and they believed all others to be decadent forms of the one true faith. It's very difficult, you got to catch yourself to the same thing. You've got the fifth epical revelation in your lap, okay? You can't let that go to your head. You need to be respectful of like I was just saying a minute ago, that pygmy in all of his primitiveness is loved just as absolutely by the Universal Father as you are. Has a thought of gesture just like you do. So, it's difficult to keep from slipping into the old wineskin definitions. You know, when you have one true faith, right? What the ghost cult thinks the word true means, and what the ghost cult thinks the word faith means, and what you could do to this in that old wineskin. They're just reminding you of how it's those two religions that are not only the most ancient, but kind of the most provide the most extended foundational nature.
India is divided among Hindu, Sikh, Mohammedan, and Jain, each picturing God, man, and the universe as these are variously conceived. China follows the Taoist and the Confucian teachings. Shinto is revered in Japan.
Yeah, again, it's like, okay, that's pretty basic, but it's just what I was saying before. It's like, okay, why is that paragraph even in here? I mean, can't I just, like, I could probably look that up in the dictionary. I wouldn't even need an encyclopedia. What's the point? The point is just to give you these little summaries to consider in this bigger context. Remember, as we started this paper, this final paper in this block about the evolution of religion, the whole point was to try to think about all these issues from the most top-down vantage point possible, not lost down in the details. So when they lay out these details, stay above them, considering them. You know, if you're going to reflect on what the facts they lay out in that paragraph, we're not going to go into it right now. But just keep that in mind. That's the basic thing that they're doing. They're saying, here's the facts. Look at them anew from as an objective a vantage point as you can. Face the facts of each of these, know where and when they are, and don't lose sight of that as you consider them. Don't you have to keep in mind the circumscribed nature of Shinto, Right? You can't think of, oh, it's just another universal consciousness, you know, and all I have to do is just approach him with that same fuzzy universal consciousness, and we'll be brothers and sisters. Yeah, it's, you know, you can't be so silly idealistic like that. You need to keep the facts in mind. Right? It's pretty difficult to separate Shinto from Japan. Okay. Other religions you can separate. You can separate Buddhism a little bit more and something. Okay, but some of them, you don't have a lot of Jainists, walking around. Okay. You know, it's a lot easier to bump into a Buddhist in Boulder, for instance. Okay. So there's those sorts of considerations. That's what they're trying to get you to think about. Right?
The great international interracial faiths are the Hebraic, Buddhist, Christian, and Islamic. Buddhism stretches from Ceylon and Burma through Tibet and China to Japan. It has shown an adaptability to the mores of many peoples that has been equaled only by Christianity.
Ta-da, what was I just saying? See, some of them are kind of naturally more generalizable than others. Again, we're always reminded as we're reading this, Ceylon and Burma, we kind of changed those names. Yeah, okay. In other words, Sri Lanka and Myanmar. but it's hard not to think of them as Ceylon and Burma still. Just notice how it starts out, the great international interracial. Why did they throw in that interracial? Because we're talking about evolutionary religion, talking about very much a religion of the mind. And mind is attuned to the racial genetics. Okay. You have to keep that in mind, too, that some of these things just, even if you have a different skin color or something, you're going to be inclined probably to favor one of these religions over another, because that's just kind of the way your genetics is. You kind of have Buddhist genetics rather than Christian genetics, right? And it's as simple as that. It's not that you've discovered that the one true faith is what you naturally are identify with. Right? You define one and true and faith by your genetic bias. See, these are the kind of things. We could just start vamping on it like this. It's a simple little, seemingly just structural sentence or statement, but they're wanting you to get, start reflecting on it like that, the consequences of what they're talking about here, and how difficult this religious system we have is to approach. It's not going to be encompassed by some simple-minded idealist. You've got to really face facts to have any success in some sort of a interreligious effort. Right? If the point is to in some way try to transcend that and not just be in the plane inter-religious, right? Bouncing two objects off of each other in the plane. All right, that's where we're going to stop. We'll finish out the paper and this whole block on the evolution of religion next time. Like I said, one of the things that they'll get into after they talk a little bit more about some of these major global religions is like, there's another big thing, like you pointed out, that's happening these days in contrast to religion, secularism, humanism. So they'll give it.
In case it wasn't complicated.
Yeah, just in case it wasn't complicated enough. Yes, right. You have these other quasi-religious, ism things that are going on. Okay, so we'll wrap things up next time. Let's take a moment here, everyone.